Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, Spotify gets in on the streaming economics debate. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me, it's Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at, I say as ever, it sounds weird after such a long break. Anyway, as ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when the UK government's Intellectual Property Office announced a new guide to music copyright that I've heard is going to be really good.
Yeah, that's definitely the word on the grapevine, isn't it? That this new
guide... It certainly is.
...called Music Copyright Explained, which actually, although announced last week, as this podcast goes out, will actually be available to download from musiccopyrightexplained.com. Yeah, very good. Really good. Put together by some really sound, knowledgeable, insightful people. I think that's a decent summary, isn't it, of what's going on here?
Yes. Our unbiased opinion is that the people who wrote it are super cool guys.
So what we're alluding to here is that the UK government's Intellectual Property Office has teamed up with CMU Insights to launch this new guide. It's called Music Copyright Explained. And basically, well, over the last few years, at various points on various podcasts, I've said various things which together explain how copyright works. And if you're an artist or a songwriter or somebody involved in the music industry or somebody who is using music, if only you could sew together all those little things we've said on the podcast over the years into one joined up piece of information, then you would know all the basic information you need about music rights, music licensing, and how music copyright makes money. Well, good news, not in audio form, but in written form. That's basically what this guide does. We've also consulted lots of people across the music industry to get their insights as well. It's all come together into this guide called Music Copyright Explained. You can download it for free as a PDF or read it on the website if you would rather do it that way. It's all there. And as part of the launch, we're running some free webinars. We've basically got the Music Copyright Explained webinar. So if you don't like reading, then in 60 minutes, I will explain all the key things you need to know that are in the guide through a webinar, which you can sign up for free at the website. And then also next month, we're going to be doing some panel discussions around music copyright as well to mark the launch of this new guide. So go to musiccopyrightexplained.com, download yourself a copy if that's of interest to you, and then sign up for the webinars and the panels and all the other stuff that's going on. However, as exciting as all that is, and that guide definitely could have its own dedicated edition of Setlist, it would be entirely reasonable to do that, but we're not doing that because that is not actually what we are here to talk about this week on Setlist.
No, later on we will be discussing calls for the Recording Academy in the US to support publishing contract reform. But first, Spotify last week launched a new website laying out its views on the economics of streaming. The website aims to explain to music makers, and probably music fans as well, its position on the economics of the streaming business and why it is not Spotify's fault if artists aren't making enough money. Actually, it is very keen to point out, it is handing over more and more money to the music industry every year. $5 billion last year and $23 billion across its history.
So yes, this new website that goes by the name Loud and Clear is coming, of course, at the end of a year when all the debates around the economics of streaming, or what we like to call the digital dollar debates, have been discussed much more publicly and much more vocally than, well, ever, I guess, and certainly for a few years now, mainly as a result of the COVID shutdown and the impact that has had on other music revenue streams. And for those artists and those people in the music community who traditionally make more money out of live activity or out of sync and merchandise or physical vinyl and CD sales, the areas of the music industry that have been negatively hit by COVID, well, those people have increasingly been looking at the money coming in from the streaming services, because we know that that money just keeps going up every year. And they're saying, well, I don't make much money from streaming. What's going on? What's wrong with the model? And so lots of debates have been going on around the world, various campaigns online, various artists and songwriters going public about their concerns, and of course here in the UK, the long-running Economics of Streaming inquiry in Parliament led by the Culture Select Committee, which is having one final hearing on the day this podcast goes out, this time with various government representatives being questioned by MPs. So yeah, in many ways, I think we can see this as Spotify finally stepping forward and saying, okay, we see this debate is going on. Various questions have been asked, various opinions have been expressed. This is our position, our views, and if you've got the time, let us explain why, well, none of it's our fault.
Yes, specifically it says, questions and concerns about artist income from streaming have been around for over a decade, and in many ways, we feel we've been too quiet on the topic. Our aim with this site is to provide a valuable foundation for a constructive conversation. In sharing more information, we hope to answer questions and share useful resources about today's streaming industry.
Yeah, well, although they say that they feel they've been too quiet on this topic for over a decade, actually, the website that we now call Spotify for Artists, which is where artists and managers can go into the Spotify system to access information and to check usage data and to update their artist metadata on the site and to pitch to playlist creators, all of those tools and services that are now available to artists and managers. That website originated in a smaller site that partly was in response to criticism that Spotify was getting back in the early days when streaming first started to really gain momentum. It was obvious it was going to become the big growth revenue stream. And I suppose Tom York most famously, but others as well around about the same time, some sort of, you know, high level artists were coming out and either saying, I've got some concerns about streaming, or streaming is terrible, streaming's no good, Spotify's bad news. And that website that became Spotify for Artists was a response to that. And in the early days, before we got all the extra sophisticated data and marketing tools and player pitching tools, quite a lot of that site was information about how streaming works, how royalties work. And that was the website that gave us that initial approximate per stream royalty that then everybody used, even though it was always an approximation. And then everybody started using that, didn't they? So when they'd heard that an artist had had a million streams, they would immediately do some maths and say, okay, well, that artist has made this much money based on that per play rate that was on the Spotify website. This time round, in this new website, which the fact they've launched a new site for this rather than just sticking it within Spotify for Artists makes me think that it probably is as much aimed at music fans as it is the music community. Because I think where you've got artists who've become critical about Spotify in the last year, maybe their fans are starting to say, oh, is Spotify bad news? Should I not be a Spotify subscriber? So it does feel that by putting all of it into a separate website, they are trying to reach maybe music fans as much as the music community. But I guess one key difference between this site versus the original version of what became Spotify for Artists is no per stream rates are being published. In fact, quite the opposite. What this site is trying to encourage is that artists and their fans should stop thinking about what is it that an artist earns every single time their track is streamed.
Yes, it says, in the streaming era, fans do not pay per song, so we don't believe a per stream rate is a meaningful number to analyse. Instead, we're focused on maximising the total size of payments we are able to make to rights holders, those that pay artists and songwriters. And we think that the data on this site reflects our progress. Now, there's a key thing there as well. It mentions the rights holders being those that pay artists and songwriters. It sort of alludes to that various times on this website, basically trying to say, look, it's not us who pays the artists and songwriters directly. There are other go-betweens like labels and publishers who actually hand out the money. So we can tell you what money we hand over, but how much actually reaches the artist, we don't know. And the labels and publishers may well be evil, but they can't say that because they're in business with the labels and publishers. So they sort of just have to allude to it a bit and leave people to make the connection.
Yeah, and I guess there's various reasons why Spotify want to stress, and in a slightly cheesy video that's on this site that explains how it works, it talks about, yeah, we don't actually have direct relationships with artists and songwriters in a commercial way, so we're paying labels and distributors on the recording side, publishers and societies on the song side. And all we can tell you is how much we're handing over. We can't tell you how much artists and songwriters receive. And that's partly because they want people to understand, particularly fans, I guess. Because, I mean, artists and songwriters, I mean, they know that's how it works. So it's another sign that this is as much for music fans as it is for artists and songwriters. Also, there's a lot of stats on this website about how much money is being handed over in total and how many artists made more than $1 million last year on Spotify and how many made $500,000, $100,000, $50,000, $5,000. And I guess it's a massive footnote to say this is how much money we handed over to the music industry. It may well be that the artists and songwriters behind these tracks saw a tiny fraction, maybe nothing, of that money down the line. And then, yes, there's this whole interesting side that, well, we've definitely noted this in the CMU Daily before, and I don't know, we've probably talked about it on Setlist as well. It's the sort of thing we would talk about, how whenever you have a debate within the artist community about streaming and streaming money and streaming royalties, and we've seen this a number of times in a number of countries, often the conversation begins with streaming is the problem. And because Spotify is the biggest streaming service in the world, certainly when it comes to premium streaming, generally that then gets translated into Spotify is the problem. But then the more the debate progresses, as obviously here in the UK for 12 months now, since we had the Broken Record campaign gaining momentum on social media, then the fixed streaming campaign from the Ivors Academy and the Musicians Union, this then led into this inquiry in Parliament. Because the debate has been moving forward over the last year here in the UK, you kind of always get to that point where actually it stops really being about Spotify being the problem. And it becomes more about, oh, maybe the problem is the music industry. Maybe the problem is the labels. And so by the time the debate even reached Parliament as part of the Culture Select Committee inquiry, Spotify, to an extent, was already off the hook. And really, it's been the major record companies that have had the most tricky questions fired at them during the inquiry. Actually, in the US, where the debate is ongoing and has been for some time, but not quite in the same way that it has here in the UK. So I think a lot of the debate in the US is still Spotify is the problem. The fact that we have the side story in the US about the rate that songwriters get being a statutory rate set in law, and then the Copyright Royalty Board increased it, and then Spotify and some others are appealing that increase, it means that, you know, the PR challenge in the US is bigger for Spotify. But it does feel like the debate in America is still much more the problem is the streaming services, the problem is Spotify, the problem is the model. Whereas here in the UK, it seems to have shifted much more onto what happens to the money as it moves into the industry. But my point is that, as you say, Spotify is always keen to stress, even if it can't completely wash its hands of responsibility in doing this, it's always keen to stress, remember, when we pass the money over, stuff happens to it before it reaches artists and songwriters. Maybe you want to think about what that stuff involves, although we're not going to slag off the major record companies because they're really important business partners for Spotify. And actually, they're still shareholders in Spotify. Certainly Universal is. I think Sony still has equity back from those original licensing deals. But various points on this website, they're keen to stress, we can only tell you what we pay the music industry. What happens once we've paid it isn't in our control and therefore isn't really our problem or fault.
Yeah, so a lot has been made of these various stats that Spotify's put out on this website. But actually, the most interesting bit of it, as far as we're concerned, and therefore you should, you as well, is the FAQ section, because that is where Spotify goes on record and answers a lot of questions that have been put to it, particularly over the last year. So about its per stream rate. It also has a bit where it's like, well, if you do want to talk about the per stream rate and how ours comes out often lower than other streaming services, here's why that is and why actually it's a good thing and you shouldn't worry about it. It also gets into talk of price increases and user-centric royalty distribution.
Yeah, so on the first of those, having said people shouldn't be obsessed about per stream rates, and to be fair, we say that as well, because you shouldn't be, because it's misleading. There's that little rate card that does the rounds on social media at least once a year that says, okay, a Spotify stream makes you this, an Apple stream makes you this, quite a lot more, a YouTube stream makes this, quite a lot less. But those rate cards are always approximations, often based on relatively small data sets. And the key point is, as Spotify explains at various points on this website, Because ultimately it's a revenue share business, and because of the way the revenue share works, actually the rates you receive will be different from country to country. They'll be different depending on whether or not the stream happened on a premium account or a free account, and they'll just be different month on month depending on how many streams were streamed in any one month. So the per stream rates are not helpful, although it then concedes, but everyone likes them. So then it goes into, yes, okay, when we see that rate card that does the rounds once a year, twice a year, three times a year on social media, that shows you that if you take all the payments coming in from the streaming services on a monthly basis and you average them out based on total number of streams, oblivious of country and subscription type, etc., then you will always find that the Spotify per stream rate is certainly lower than the Apple rate, and usually Tidal's a bit higher too, although it is ahead of things like YouTube, which is usually quite far down. But Spotify says you have to understand that the reason for that is A, Spotify has a free tier and Apple doesn't, and that then has an impact on the average. Second, Spotify is bigger in some key emerging markets, and in emerging markets, the subscription price is lower, which means when you average out the money per stream, there's less money. And thirdly, they claim, I don't quite know based on what, but they claim Spotify subscribers are full-on music fans. They're listening to more music, and that's why across the board, the average rates go down. But as you said, they're basically saying, but all of these things are good things, because the fact that we have more users because we have the free level, the fact that we're growing our audiences in these emerging markets, the fact that our subscribers listen to more music, all means as an artist, you have more chance of reaching an audience, a big audience, a global audience, and you should love that. And on one level, they're right, although on another level, it's actually really hard to build a fan base on the streaming services. The direct-to-fan tools on platforms like Spotify have always been a bit lackluster. So this idea that you can build a massive global fan base by having your music on Spotify isn't a perfect argument, but I mean, they are, in essence, saying what I always say when people get that rate card out and say, look, Spotify is so much less than Apple. It's like, well, you've got to understand the complexities that are going on there. So that's what they say about the per stream rates that they don't want you to talk about. But if you do talk about, you've got to think about these things that impact on Spotify's rate. Then when it comes to price rises, you mentioned that they talk about, well, if it's a revenue share business and there are no per stream rates, but we all agree that artists aren't getting enough money, why don't you just put up the subscription prices?
Yeah, and this is where Spotify pulls out one of its common lines, which is that it single-handedly ended piracy, or words to that effect. It says here, Spotify persuaded listeners to pay a set price for music monthly, shifting fans away from piracy. The cost of a subscription is not an insignificant amount for many. Raising prices is a fine balance. We don't want to drive people back to piracy or unmonetized solutions. And it does have something of a point there, particularly about the cost of a subscription. I mean, £120 a year is a lot more than most people were spending a year on music in the CD era. I mean, for someone who spent a lot of money on CDs, such as myself, then £120 a year probably seems like you're getting a bit of a deal. But yeah, for most people, convincing them to make that jump to £10 a month, which would be one CD a month, I guess, which is not what people were spending on music in the main back in the 90s or early 2000s. That is a leap for most people and something that all the streaming services have had to overcome.
Yeah, although, that said, one of the arguments that has come up increasingly, certainly here in the UK, as the whole broken record fixed streaming debate has evolved, is, okay, even if we accept that, it is actually a simple fact that Spotify's basic rate has been £10 a month or £9.99 a month ever since it launched, more than 10 years ago. So actually, because of inflation, the price has been coming down every year. So even if we say we can't really expect the average music consumer to be spending more than £120 a year on music, well, the rate should at very least be keeping up with inflation. And we should be having annual price rises, which we have seen on sort of Netflix type services over the years. Although Spotify then added that, okay, there will have to be some price rises at some point. We accept that. And actually, they said, we've already begun that process.
Yeah, it said Spotify is always evaluating pricing in each of our markets, and we've increased pricing in a number of them. Since Spotify and artist rights holders share in the same pool of money, our incentives are totally aligned. We both want to generate as much revenue from listeners and advertisers as possible. Over the years, we've made a number of price increases in different markets around the world, and we will continue to do so when it makes sense, based on a variety of local and regional factors.
And as for the good old user-centric debate as to whether or not we should shift over to a user-centric system for divvying up the money between the different tracks rather than a service-centric or pro-rata or market-centric or whatever you want to call it, we're not going to talk about what user-centric is because we've talked about it too many times on Setlist. Maybe Andy will put a link in the notes, because if you don't know what user-centric is, to an article on the website or a past podcast where we explain it. But in terms of what is Spotify's position on user-centric, it basically says, we don't think that it helps, but if the industry wants it, we'll do it.
Yeah, it says that the research that it's seen to date suggests that it will make very little difference in terms of what artists earn compared to the existing model. But it says, we are willing to make the switch to a user-centric model if that's what the artists, songwriters, and rights holders want to do. However, Spotify cannot make this decision on its own. It requires broad industry alignment to implement this change.
Now, Spotify's rival Deezer was quick to note that Spotify had put an official opinion about user-centric on its website. Deezer, of course, is a streaming service which is very pro the idea that we should shift over to a user-centric system. It's trying to persuade labels and distributors to do a pilot in France, possibly Germany, has been for quite some time now. And it put out a statement saying, well, even though Spotify was a bit, we're agnostic on this, we don't think it helps, but if we have to, we'll do it. Deezer reckons Spotify could be a bit more gung-ho on the potential benefits of user-centric. So basically, Alexander Holland from Deezer said, streaming today lacks both transparency and fairness and benefits the people at the top of the food chain. He conceded that user-centric doesn't magically solve all of those problems. However, he said, it does treat every artist equally and it makes sure that you as a fan support the artist you love. Saying that something isn't worth doing because it doesn't matter enough to you is what defenders of the status quo have always done. And in the end, fairness and change always prevails. And then he said, we continue to pursue a user-centric payment system simply because it's the right thing to do and it's fair for everyone involved. No ifs, no buts. And we continue to call on labels to work with us on this pilot in France and possibly Germany.
Talking of responses to this website, you kind of alluded earlier to the fact that responses to this have been slightly different in the UK compared to the US. So in the UK, the Ivers Academy, which ran that Fix streaming campaign, their CEO, Graham Davis, said, we welcome Spotify's new initiative as a step in the right direction of providing music creators with greater transparency. Knowledge is power. We have campaigned for greater transparency about how streaming works and how songwriters and composers are paid. However, he went on, the figures from Spotify that show payouts are not what goes into the pockets of artists and songwriters. It is what labels and publishers receive, who then pay artists and songwriters a fraction of that. This is where the industry still has a long way to go to achieve true transparency and fair distribution. But well done, Spotify, for recognising the importance of transparency and showing that it is possible. So that's, as you were saying, the general view in the UK that perhaps it's not Spotify that's totally to blame for this. There are issues with the music industry itself, the way it's structured, the way its contracts work, that mean that artists and songwriters are not seeing the amount of money that they should be from the boom in streaming. The Musicians Union, which was also involved in the Fix streaming campaign, had said basically the same thing. Their General Secretary, Horace Troubridge, said that they were delighted to welcome the launch of Spotify's Loud and Clear website. It said that with the Fix streaming campaign, they'd been calling for more clarity and transparency in the way platforms pay out to the rights holders, and it was great to see Spotify respond in such a positive way. But then similarly went on to say, however, it does underline the fact that whilst the success of streaming is generating huge dividends, it is the rights owners who are benefiting chiefly, and the artists and performers who write and deliver the music that the whole ecosystem depends on are at best the poor relations.
So yeah, here in the UK, generally a positive response to the fact this website has launched. They see it as a good venture on the part of Spotify, although then stress it kind of plays into what the Irish Academy and the MU and others have been saying, certainly over the last year and actually in many cases for years now, which is streaming at large is good news. The industry at large is doing well out of streaming, but we still have issues with the way the money is shared out between songs and recordings, and then on the recording side between labels and artists. So Spotify has done its bit by being more transparent, but the industry still needs to do its bit by finding a fairer way for sharing out the money.
Now, in the US, as we said, a slightly different response. The relatively new Union of Musicians and Allied Workers, which has its own campaign called Justice at Spotify, which and as part of that last week, it held protests outside Spotify's offices calling for higher per-stream rates for artists. So that's very clearly, you know, a different outlook to the campaign that's been going on in the UK. And in a statement on Twitter in response to this new website, they said, "Spotify has failed to meet any of our demands. The company consistently deflects blame onto others for systems it has itself built and from which it has created its nearly $70 billion valuation. We asked for transparency, but this website answers none of our questions about the sources of Spotify's income in addition to subscriptions and ads, payola schemes for playlists, and algorithm prioritization, or the terms of their contracts with the major labels." It also said that it would have a more complete statement in the coming days, so we await with interest what is contained within that response.
Interesting that they honed in on Spotify's market cap valuation in that statement there. That has come up quite a lot, actually, in the last year, because we can't really criticize Spotify for all the profits it's making on the back of streaming music, because it isn't. It's still basically a loss-making company for various reasons. But it is true that the valuation of the business has been growing over the last year. I mean, actually, in more recent days and weeks, it's been slipping again. So actually, that $70 billion valuation they mentioned is a few weeks ago now, I think. It's slumped quite a bit since then. Although, I mean, that valuation is still significantly higher today than it was back when it first listed on the New York Stock Exchange. In fact, long-time listeners of Setlist might be interested to know that the single share that we bought in Spotify back when it listed on the New York Stock Exchange has more or less doubled in value.
Wow.
So I reckon
we could have pudding now with our dinner.
I can't quite remember what we paid for it. I think we paid about $135. Does that ring a bell?
Something like that.
And now it's $270 as we record this podcast. So if COVID lockdown ever ends and me and Andy are allowed to be in the same restaurant at the same time at some point this year, we can actually have a pretty decent meal on our profit from our single share. And obviously, artists and songwriters would say that is why they are right to focus on the valuation of Spotify, even though it's a loss-making business, because evil capitalists like CMU cashed in by buying shares when Spotify first listed. And then since then, the share price has been going up, up, up. And those are the people, as well as the majors, who are profiting from this, not artists and songwriters. But whatever you think about these sorts of arguments, I think we can agree that that particular increasingly vocal campaign about streaming in the US was not very impressed with a Loud and Clear website.
No, and I imagine it will continue to be unimpressed for some time yet. And I imagine we'll come back to this story again and again. And I mean, probably we'll keep doing this story until all music ever is just automatically stored inside everyone's brains and payment for music becomes a thing of the past.
And then hopefully someone will launch a website about that and we could talk about that as well.
Sticking with things that are related to artist and songwriter contracts, as I guess that was in there, wasn't it, with the last bit? A number of artist and songwriter groups in the US have welcomed the launch of a new songwriters and composers wing of the Recording Academy, obviously the organisation that organises the Grammys, which took place a little over a week ago now. Though they've also called on that new wing to immediately back their campaign against a classic provision in music publishing contracts called the Minimum Delivery and Release Commitment.
So yes, the Recording Academy actually used Grammy Weekend to announce that they were launching this new wing of the organisation, specifically for songwriters and composers. So traditionally, the Recording Academy, I guess, well, the clue's kind of in the name, isn't it? They've been more focused on the recording side of the music industry.
Yes.
So artists and producers and studio people, but very much trying to bring songwriters and composers into the fold. I suppose recognising that increasingly the debates around the music industry and the rights of music makers see artists and songwriters in very much side by side with similar concerns. And also sometimes there is an issue that's specifically for recordings, and sometimes there's an issue that's specifically for songs. But if both artists and songwriters campaign on both, bearing in mind that a lot of music makers are both anyway, then often more things happen. So yes, the Recording Academy launched this new songwriter and composer wing. The chair of the Recording Academy, Harvey Mason, said, "The musical process begins with our fellow songwriters and composers, and so we are thrilled, no less, to launch this wing at the Academy that creates a home for music storytellers across the country. These creatives are essential to the music community, and we look forward to collaborating with our industry colleagues to support, educate, and empower the diverse members in these crafts." And as you said at the start of this section, various other groups in the US who speak for either songwriters specifically or both artists and songwriters said, "This is great. We're really glad the Recording Academy, which is obviously a high-profile organisation, particularly around the Grammys, we're glad that you're going to be more actively involved in campaigning for songwriters and composers. And while you're there, there's one specific campaign that we're all involved in that we think you should embrace."
Yeah, so these different organisations were the Songwriters of North America, the Music Artists Coalition, the Black Music Action Coalition, and the 100%ers, who all welcomed the launch of this new wing of the Recording Academy, but said in an open letter published by Variety, "As you know, the work of songwriters and composers is not only the backbone of our industry, it is the soundtrack to our lives. Despite the pivotal role played by songwriters and composers, they have too often been an afterthought in the music industry. As such, the Recording Academy's efforts to establish this new arm must be applauded. We welcome you and hope you will join us in the ongoing fight for fairer treatment and pay for songwriters and composers in the new digital music ecosystem."
Now, with the mention of the digital music ecosystem there, you might think, oh, we can see what campaign they're wanting the Recording Academy to get involved in. It's the aforementioned appeal by the streaming services against the Copyright Royalty Board ruling that increased the rate that songwriters and publishers get from streaming. And the fact that Spotify et al. Are appealing that increase, that's a big controversy. Clearly, that is what the Recording Academy is going to be called on to support. Come with us, Artists and Songwriters of America. Let's join up with the music publishers as well and fight the evil streaming services who are trying to keep their royalty payments down. But no, that is not the campaign that these groups were prioritising. In fact, the campaign they were prioritising sees songwriters against the music publishers rather than campaigning with them.
Yeah, so this open letter goes on. "As the first collective effort with the Songwriters and Composers Wing of the Recording Academy, we are asking you to join us in our campaign towards the swift and comprehensive elimination of the minimum delivery and release commitment requirement." That commitment being a common term in traditional publishing deals, which means that not only is the songwriter obliged to deliver a certain number of songs to the publisher under that deal, but for a portion of those songs, there must be a commercially released recording. And in many cases, that clause also says that the recordings must be released by a major record company or pre-approved larger independent label.
Yeah, so as you say, this clause, sometimes abbreviated to the MDRC, is quite common in publishing contracts, certainly in the US, but in some other countries too. And under a normal publishing deal, as a songwriter, when you sign to a publisher and then they advance you some money and they provide you various services and support, and in return for that, they possibly take ownership of your song rights or certain elements of your song rights for a period of time, or at the very least, they have under license the right to exploit those rights. Usually in a publishing contract, you are obliged to deliver to the publisher a certain number of songs. You could do a publishing contract for a number of years, but usually you'll say, okay, we're going to advance you this money, we're going to give you this support, and you need to deliver to us 10 published songs. And we will then either own the rights in those songs or we'll control those songs, usually for a number of years, and we'll make money out of those songs, which we'll then share with you as the songwriter. And because songwriters often co-write, it will be 100% 10 songs. So if the songwriter actually usually does a 50-50 split on the songs they write, then it'll be 20 songs to get 10 songs 100%, if that makes sense. So that's how publishing contracts work. But yeah, this extra commitment. And I suppose if you look at it from the publisher's side, there's the risk that you sign a songwriter, you advance them some money, you do a load of work for them, and they deliver you the 10 songs that they're obliged to deliver you. But then nobody ever releases recordings of those songs. And in a way, until recordings of songs are released, I mean, yes, the songs may still be performed at shows, and technically there is money to be made when songs are performed at shows, but you make the serious money once a song has been released, because then you get your cut of all the recording revenue. And of course, once a song has been recorded and released, it is more likely to be performed at bigger live shows where the royalties for the songwriters and the publishers are higher. So you don't want to end up with 10 songs that nobody releases and therefore aren't worth a lot of money. So you put this clause in that says, okay, of the songs, a certain portion need to have a commercial release. And then as we say, often you then are even more specific than that. You say a major label release or a release on a pre-approved indie label. Now, the thing about this requirement is, if the songwriter is also an artist and they're releasing their own music, especially if they're signed to a major label, well, that's a really easy commitment to sign up to, because I'm going to write some songs, I'm going to release a record with my label partner, and immediately all the songs I've written for you are going to be commercially released. Tick that box, done. But if you're a songwriter who predominantly writes for other artists, you don't necessarily have control over whether or not those songs are recorded, and if they are, who releases them, how they're released, etc. And then indeed, you could argue one of the jobs of the publisher in that scenario is to find labels who want to release those songs. So almost you could say as a songwriter, well, it's your job to get these released. And if you fail in that job, you're then punishing me by saying, even though I've delivered you my 10 songs, I'm still bound by this contract because three of those songs didn't get a major label release. And of course, in the current era of the music industry, if it is a commitment that says a major label release, that ignores the fact that ever-increasing amounts of music are released by independents or by self-releasing artists working with distributors. And so the argument increasingly in the US for a while now has been these clauses are outdated, they're old-fashioned, they don't work in the streaming age. Actually, they're not even fair, they shouldn't be in there. So various organisations have been campaigning for publishers to remove these clauses, not only out of new publishing deals, but out of legacy publishing deals as well. And that is where these various organisations want Recording Academy support, that they will join the campaign to get rid of these clauses in publishing contracts, old and new.
So they say this archaic provision keeps thousands of songwriters and composers locked into oppressive, never-ending publishing deals. This necessary change must apply to all publishing deals going forward, as well as retroactively. And it concludes, the music industry is evolving and we look forward to working with this new wing of the Recording Academy to ensure that songwriters and composers are not taken advantage of any longer, but instead are treated with the respect they deserve. We are at your disposal to lend whatever assistance we can in your newly organised efforts in the fight for the fair treatment of songwriters and composers.
So it remains to be seen if the Recording Academy gets behind this campaign. It has already enjoyed some success, this campaign. The majors, for example, BMG, have committed to make changes in this regard. But what the campaigners are looking for is industry-wide change on this point. And so a little bit of help from the Recording Academy would be appreciated.
But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to get deeper into anything we've discussed here today, you can go to the show notes at setlistpodcast.com or in your podcast player, where you'll find links to everything we've talked about. Don't forget to subscribe to the show if you haven't. Rate and review it, because that helps it get out to more people. And if you've got any questions, email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moulton, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.